Hello, welcome! Season 2, Confessions of an Aging Ingenue. I'm Jenny Tooley, your aging ingenue. I'm so excited that you're here today. Before we jump on into this episode, I wanted to let you know I have made a new treat for you. It's the Interactive Companion Guide for Season 1. Yes, Interactive Companion Guide, Confessions of an Aging Ingenue, Season 1. Jump on over to jennytooley.com to get more information. We're also going to be offering a mentorship program this year, so make sure that you are getting your monthly newsletter so that you can get all the insider tips and info. All right, what you've been waiting for? Here we go. Hey, everybody. I'm Jenny Tooley, your aging ingenue. Today, we have a good friend and collaborator of mine. Oh, long-term collaborator, Bruce Richardson. I'm so excited to have Bruce here today. How are you, Bruce?
I am doing so well. And your long-term collaborator.
Long-term collaborator. So before we get into that, would you go ahead and introduce yourself?
All righty. I'm Bruce. I'm a... I'm a guy who started out going to college thinking he wanted to be a band director. And then I thought, oh, my God, I can't do this. So I switched gears and played jazz and wrote music and just kind of did my own thing, got a composition degree instead, and ended up in Dallas working crazy jobs on movies where I could get them, doing things that were anything but composing music. And suddenly I get a bite from a guy I know named Randy Perry, and I end up on a crazy Bill Irwin clown show in a suburb. And that brings me to the first time I laid eyes on Jenny Tooley. She was standing on a balcony in a rehearsal room in character for a production meeting. So, I think you were running lines with, you might have been running lines with Shambly. Somebody was down and you were up. And I thought, well, look at that, man. That is the very picture in the dictionary next to ingenue.
Oh, my gosh.
Embodiment.
I had no idea I was going to get such a great introduction as well there.
Oh, my God. You were, I just thought, there it is, man. That's an actress.
Oh, thank you.
So, there it began.
So that show was Three Cuckolds.
Yup.
Which was a Commedia dell'arte style show, which I had never done.
Before or since.
Before or since, exactly.
It got us in the theater history book.
Did it?
The Oscar Brockett. Our staff photo, our production photo from the Three Cuckolds, the one where we all had weird sunglasses on, was in an edition of the Oscar Brockett. Kateri's got it. Kateri Kale. Oh. She's got the book. We're in the history books, baby.
Man, I learned something new every day. I mean, seriously, it just kind of goes, people are like, didn't you know that? And I'm like, no, I have no idea. I had no idea. Okay, so that's interesting.
Yep.
I would not have thought that show would have been something. I guess that just tells you exactly, you just never know when you're working on a project, where it's going to go or what it's going to do.
That's right. I mean, that was a great cast. That was one of the, if you had to pick an all-star cast, oh my God, you got Frank Krim. We didn't staple anything to his head, but we did almost everything you could do to him other than stapling something to his head. Chambly.
Yeah.
Cherry, Jane. Oh, my God.
Yeah, that was a good show. Yep. That was a fun show. Okay, so that was the first. So then, let's see. So we went, that was at Addison Center Theater.
Yep.
And you composed the music for that?
I wore silk boxers, ugly black shoes that I marched drum corps in, and black socks and garters, and from the waist up, I was in a tux.
Nice.
Thank you, Guyva.
Yeah, so you performed live for that as well.
Yep. I was the one on the balcony at that point. Remember, I was up stage left, kind of suspended over the audience, and I had a piano and a bunch of stuff to honk on, trumpets, all sorts of things. And
that's right.
I was the antagonist to all the proceedings. I was up there basically just to be an annoyance and break in when things got dicey down on stage.
Yeah, there was a combination. So we even what are they called? The caper cops? We did all sorts of crazy stuff in that show. We did the bring the audience member on stage in the middle of the play. Like,
the
they
light
don't
covers.
Know. That was just evil.
It was. It was. The setup was great. They didn't let the latecomers in. They sequestered them, and they said, "We're going to sneak you in very quietly. There's a little break coming up, so just follow me." And they led them in a little circuitous path onto a door that opened up center stage and just plopped them out on the stage. There was a knock at the door. And
right.
Ted would say, "Oh, latecomers," and come open the door, and then the fanfare, the mighty fanfare, played over the speakers, and they were humiliated for 2 or 3 minutes, and then sent to their seats.
And then the play resumed.
Yes, that's really kind of a great play.
Yeah, it really is.
I mean, how much fun did we have? I don't remember having more fun on a theater show, frankly.
Really?
I mean, some of them have been, God knows I've done a ton of them, but that one was just pure, unadulterated, crazy fun.
And that was in 1990-something.
That's what I was trying to figure out. Was that before you did Bottle Rocket? Or after?
That's a great question. The first play I ever did professionally was The Red Plays at the Undermain.
Oh.
I would have been 19.
That's one of the few I didn't see.
Oh, yeah. That would have been like 1991. And then I went straight into this show.
Wow.
So it might have been 1992.
That's probably right, because I had just come off of JFK, and that was 1991.
So you had worked on the JFK movie, the Oliver Stone movie.
Yes.
In Dallas.
Yes.
What did you do on that?
I was, I started out being a scenic artist on it. And then after they figured out I knew what I was doing, which I didn't, but I faked it super well. They put me on stage as the onstage scenic artist, because there was another one already. And, they were blowing and going, and they needed a second on stage artist. So they brought me on to work with that guy when we were shooting together. And then I'd go with the B-roll crew if I wasn't needed on the hot set.
Okay. What did you do on the set as a scenic artist?
Mostly sat around.
So you knew how to sit around, right? That was...
Yeah, I could do very well. But, you know, the onstage artist basically, like, if something gets missed through every other step of the art direction channel, and the director goes up and sticks his eye on the eyepiece and says, something doesn't look right there, then that's when they go wake up the onset artist and they say, fix this. So,
okay. And as I understand it, Oliver Stone was pretty exacting in his process.
He was pretty exacting. He's a funny guy. He's occasionally mercurial. Mm-hmm. John Larroquette looked at his lines. He played like the Johnny Carson character, and he was interviewing Costner's character, and I was touching up something they noticed on the little desk in front of the talking head talk show guy. Mm-hmm. And John, I'll never forget it, he said, I don't know, Oliver, this just sounds a little eggy. And I don't know what was going on that day, but that hit Oliver wrong. And suddenly I was trapped on my knees between Oliver Stone and John Larroquette, absolutely having it out. And so I just turned and locked eyes with Kevin Costner, and he locked eyes with me, and we hunkered down and shared a moment.
So, you know,
that
I think
JFK for me, nuttiness.
Nuttiness?
Yeah. What am I doing here?
Right. And I think we take it for granted when we're watching a movie. We don't see all those little things. Like whatever you were doing on the desk was probably something very small, wasn't it?
I was retouching a logo. Uh-huh. That had somehow gotten scuffed. Mm-hmm. The whole scene got thrown out anyway because it all pissed Oliver off. So he was like, get that out of my movie. And there's the that's it for movies, really.
Yeah, right.
You can be there 12 hours a day, and that might have been the best piece of work I ever did. It wasn't, but nevertheless, on a whim, it's gone.
Absolutely. Been there many, many times.
Yep.
Went to the movie and I'm like, wait a second. Where is that scene?
I know I was in this movie.
I know I was. I know I was in Courage Under Fire. I remember meeting Denzel Washington. No.
Yep.
So around 1992, okay, we've done three Cuckolds, and then we went into Deatherians at the Undermain. Is that right?
That we worked on together?
Yeah. No.
I bet so, because I did Macbeth in the interim.
Okay.
We don't have to say the Scottish play here, right?
I don't think so.
I haven't been.
Everybody get up and turn around three times.
I'll just put my water bottle on my head. It should work.
The Deatherians was a John O'Keefe play at the Undermain Theater. That was a whole different experience of balls out crazy.
Boy, was it.
I don't even know how to set the stage for the Deatherians. That was...
Well, you know, he says it's an allegory and that it is his... It's essentially his little personal diatribe about regional theater.
Okay. So we have like a Kevorkian thing going on in this play. We've got a whole Amsterdam stripper thing going on in this play. We've got dead meat coats, people taking people's skin from other people to make coats out of them, and this is an allegory. Okay.
Yep.
All right.
That's what John says.
Fascinating.
So I'm not sure that John is still with us.
I'm not sure many of the audience members probably got that.
Gonna think that nobody got that. It was really a big dare, right? Who dares produce this play?
Right.
And
yeah, I wish I could figure out how to talk about it a little bit differently, but it was almost like a big B movie is how we approached it eventually. A big B, old school sci-fi kind of Martians are attacking the Earth kind of style play.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, you opened the show. It was, you did the little song about how you the Amsterdam dancer slash whatever would separate men from their money in Amsterdam, the soft nightmare.
The soft nightmare.
Yes.
I learned a lot.
Well, I mean, it was gotta hand it to you there. That was daring. That was a daring performance on your part, tip to tail.
And it was not a role. So I played Marivia Slovalichka.
Yes.
I am Marivia Slovalichka. Slovalichka.
Yes. My name is Marivia Slovalichka.
Yes. Yes. My name. So, yes, this was a play with music.
Yep.
Marivia Slovalichka was in a big plastic box on stage, basically a peep show box.
Yes.
And also when she came out of this box, she was a stripper and did strip teases.
Yes.
And then by the end of the play, she has seduced a guy played by the other Bruce at the time.
Yes. Become impregnated.
To become impregnated. This is only one storyline, y'all. To become impregnated. And did she get him to go out and collect pieces for the meat suit that she ended up?
Yes. He murdered. She sent him out to murder people. Bring me the left hand of a priest. He killed a priest and he would, what do you call it when you cut the skin off of somebody? There's a fancy medieval word for it.
I don't know.
He'd skin them. He'd skin them and bring you the pieces, and you sewed them by hand, I suppose. We never saw it happen. You sewed them into a meat suit that you would wear and dance.
Right.
Something apocalyptic. I don't know what.
And then the birth of this baby, literally, the baby was cut out of my stomach.
That's right. While I was
in the meat suit.
That's right. And the baby gave the closing, closing monologue. That's it.
That's it. Again, only one storyline from this play. Okay. So we did music on stage, but you did not do music on stage with us.
Nope. It was all pre-produced and canned. And this was back in the days when you had to do it on a bunch of cassettes. And I remember there was about a banker's box full of music and sound cues on that show. It was probably way too complicated for anyone to have ever handled, but somehow they did.
Mm-hmm. And we wrote those songs together, the actors and you, and then performed them. I remember being on that stage one night, and we had a heckler in the audience. So this would have been in 1993.
Oh, I was there the heckler night.
Were you?
Yes.
So I was out there dancing in the guys, like heckling, right?
Yep.
This was before cell phones and videos and all that stuff. So nobody had a cell phone. Thank God. I can't even imagine doing that today where people just can pop out their cell phones and record everything.
Do you remember what happened to the heckler?
Oh, I do. But I'm going to have you tell the story because I think you'll tell it even better.
Well, the heckler turned out to be drunk. So at some point, he got up and was like, where's the bathroom? And so I forget who it was.
I believe it was Bruce DuBose, I think, was the one that was, he was so mad.
Yes. So they guided him through a little hallway that was behind where the audience was seated and opened a door and said, it's through there. But that was a fire door to the alley and they just closed it. So he was disposed of.
Which really fits with that play.
It was an elegant solution.
It really was. I felt so taken care of at that point, like, you know, that my collaborators were willing to take care of that.
Well, from the young ingenue perspective, you were out there on an absolute, you were on a strand of dental floss for a tightrope. So, hats off to you for even doing that thing.
Thank you. I don't even think I thought about it at that point. It just seemed like it was going to be a lot of fun.
Well, you were surrounded by people who were looking out after your interest. So
yeah. Yeah, that's true.
And we did it. You know, I don't think anyone's done it since. Who would?
That's a great question. I don't know.
You know, John has, because John was an orphan, John O'Keefe we're talking about, and he came up in an orphanage. He did that play. He did that one-man show, Shimmer, about it, and, you know, went through so much as a kid himself, and his father was a sailor who took off and never came back, you know? Mm-hmm. So he worked the Odysseus myth into everything. And the baby at the very end of the show is kind of regurgitating the Odysseus myth. So, that's another thing that the play was strung off of.
So we went from Deatherians.
Chekhov.
Oh, did we? Oh my gosh, I totally forgot about that. Okay, we did Chekhov. We did the Seagull. Okay.
Seagull. You were the ingenue again.
Yes. Thus the name of this podcast.
Yep.
The ingenue. I don't think a lot of people know what an ingenue is, and I'm really curious nowadays what people, if that term fits anymore.
It's kind of gone out. We still have them, but it's not fashionable to admit that you are one.
Right, because of diversity. I don't think that an ingenue in the time that I was an ingenue and before then, that there would have been a person of color in that role, really.
Really?
Really? You don't think so?
I don't know. You know, I don't like the word colorblind because I think the word colorblind is really, it's just like being in denial, you know? You have to know what people of different colors and backgrounds were treated like. I mean, I grew up in Longview, Texas. It was horrible for people of color. It was deplorable. Mm-hmm. And how did I get fortunate enough to be born to parents who just were not having it? Man, if I came home with a little white cracker friend, they would say, time for you to go home, as soon as it was convenient to dismiss him. And they'd sit me down and say, this is not who you hang out with. This isn't who you are. Mm-hmm. You know, and they, for some reason, thankfully, that was a big deal. And, I realize this is diverging, but I want to tell you a story about my father.
Okay.
Who I was probably maybe 12, 13 years old. I would go to work in his shop. He did like precision parts for the oil industry, and he was part of a kind of a three business cluster that produced these parts. And he was the tail end of the chain. They did the precision stuff. And he hired this amazing guy, Irvin Smith. He was just the very picture of a 70s fashionable black dude. You know, he had a big afro. He was a very intelligent guy. He loved music. He ran that shop. He was my father's shop foreman, and he ran that shop like it just ran like a clock. Mm-hmm. And I loved Irvin. And when I would go work part time over the summers, or get part time work from my dad to earn some money for something, loved Irvin. God, I remember David Bowie had Fame on the radio at the time. This is where it falls in on the timeline. And man, Irvin and I would just be screaming Fame, Fame, and had the best memories of him. But I remember Dad would hire people, and they would, when they were introduced to the shop foreman, these guys would be like, oh, hell no, I'm not taking any orders from a N-word. Mm. And man, they would be gone. They would be gone on the instant. My dad would just look at them and say, well, you better pack up your tools then, because that's the shop foreman. That's Irvin. He's my right-hand guy. Mm. And so I don't know. Maybe I got out of East Texas. And so, mm-hmm. you know, that question you ask, would a person of color have even been considered up to be an ingenue role? Mm-hmm. Kind of pisses me off that I'm colorblind, that I wouldn't say, of course they wouldn't, because that's probably the answer, right? At least in mainstream film.
I think so. I haven't done a thorough search. If there's somebody out there that has, please, you know, comment or email me. But I haven't done a thorough search on this. But just in general, that's what I'm seeing. Is now today it's different. I don't even know if these ingenue roles exist anymore, because the ingenue role was so
downgraded.
Downgraded. She didn't have a lot of power most of the time. Her power was right. In being powerless. That's how I did the seagull, actually.
Yep.
Her power was in being weak, kind of weak and victim-y, right?
Yes. And so you were able to finagle your way to a higher position by utilizing your exposure in the play.
Right. Exactly. Within the circumstances of the play.
Yes. And the little play that you start in on another little pod that just didn't have fiberglass, that didn't have plexiglass walls.
Right. So within the story of the seagull, there's a play within a play.
Yep.
And Catherine decided to do that play within a play as, was that theater? Kabuki?
Yeah, kind of kabuki theater. Catherine was very into kabuki theater at the time.
So we were
She'd
all
just
like
done a big Macbethian Macbeth thing with a lot of the kabuki theater elements in it.
They were, yeah, we were down there doing this big. This type of theater was based in around. Okay, so our play within a play. So we have a Russian play by Chekhov
Yes.
that we're doing in an experimental theater in Dallas.
Yes.
Within that play, there is a little play that Chekhov has written for the characters to perform, and Catherine has applied the kabuki style of performance to it, which is based in the atom bomb, right? I don't think it's the kabuki. I think this is the no theater, but the atom bomb and people screaming silently.
Oh. What is that?
Can't remember what it's called. I thought it
Yeah.
started with an N.
Yeah, Cat was always one step ahead of all of us, and I just recall how it went. It was you doing sort of an interpretive dance thing, and the lights. It got very high tech and very, very abstract out of the blue. It was probably just ridiculously self-indulgent. I might cringe if I went back and saw what we did, but it did kind of it fell into the Undermain vibe, and of course you were beautiful in it, as you always were.
Thank you.
And it was a lovely performance, and it did get it across that what was Bruce's character? Trigorin, right? That Trigorin was smitten with you on the instant.
Right. So of course there's the ingenue. That's a man is smitten with me, the
Yes, a
character.
man has become smitten with your character.
So we get to the end of that play, and there's a scene where she goes, quote, crazy. Like, that's the way a lot of people read it. She goes crazy. And the way I had interpreted this, that character has all this stuff that she goes through with these guys. There's multiple guys, of course, that are vying for her attention. And she goes off with one of them. She goes off with Trigorin, right? The older man instead of the younger man, into the city. And then she comes back because he has ditched her or something. She comes back and sees the people, or maybe not. Anyhow, she comes back and she has this final scene where she's kind of crazy. And she's going off of these monologues and blah, 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 blah. And I actually interpreted that for myself as she had gone off to the city and returned and was no longer speaking these people's language, and she had kind of found a piece of herself in this whole thing. So it made her look like she was crazy. She believes she faints as well in the middle of that scene. I just remember falling to the ground.
Oh, wow.
So it was a different kind of interpretation, I think, than and now that I look back at it, I'm kind of like, oh. Sometimes when we go through a shift in our lives and we have an awakening for ourselves, we come back to the place we were, and we look different and we look like we have lost our minds because we're no longer in that same construct that the people that we were with before are still in. Did that make
Oh,
sense?
of course. I get it all the time when I go back to Longview to deal with business or go to class reunions, and the people who didn't leave, I mean, they're people, they're growing, they're learning, they're traveling, they're doing their things, but there's a social structure that's intact from the moment I left in 1977. And that social structure still fully exists and has just moved forward from that moment uninterrupted there. And those of us who left and come back to it are always surprised by it, right? Because if you've left your childhood home and you've moved on and you've done things in life and you've traveled and you've had different roles, you grow in all those roles and you change in all those roles, and they change you, they get in you and become you. Mm-hmm. And I wondered what I would have been like if I had stayed. Mm-hmm. If I'd thought, well, let me just stake my claim on life right here in Longview, Texas, in this red clay, and see what I become.
Did you ever feel like you felt in fit in there though, like nope. as you were growing up?
Nope. I knew I didn't.
I always felt like one of the odd people out in Lucas and Allen, Texas. And it wasn't until I went back a few decades later that I really got that that's because I was. Like, I did not fit into the culture there.
Yeah.
I don't fit into the culture there definitely now. And I am curious sometimes about people who, like, I'm grateful I was able to move out of that. Because yeah. I think if I was still in it, I would be losing my mind, and I just feel really confused and down. I think I'd be depressed. I think I'd be pretty depressed.
Yeah. You'd have to find yourself there somehow, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we all, I think, are on this daily process of finding we never do. I don't think we ever do, but we're seeking to find ourselves and to understand our role in the universe. But if the universe is small, then maybe there aren't so many roles up for grabs. Mm-hmm. Mm. I don't know. I try not to ponder that. I'm pondering too much already.
Okay, so the sequel.
Take that off your ponder list.
Yeah, you got after a while, you got to take some things off the ponder list in order to be happy. We talked about this the other day, to be happy enough.
Yeah, I love happy enough. Happy enough is happy.
Yep, I agree with you.
Yeah.
Happy is enough is happy. I do good enough because of my perfectionist streak. So good enough is good enough.
Yeah. Your good enough is many people's perfection. So plenty good enough.
Thank you. And then the good enough, eventually, if you do it good enough, it is perfect. If yeah. it's good enough, it's good enough.
Right. I'll buy that. It's interesting. My attorney, Andy Korn, his nickname is Gator. He got recommended to me when someone brought a legal scrape to me, not a scrape of my making, and I needed some help figuring out what to do. And I asked my good friend Mike Northrup, who's an appellate attorney that's very reserved and brilliant. I'm like, who's the meanest guy you know? Who's the meanest, competent, smart attorney you know who can absolutely destroy someone if they have to do it? Because I need that kind of legal help. And he's like, oh, you want my friend Andy. And so, I mean, this guy, Andy, I love him. He became one of my favorite people because he's analytical. He's extremely compassionate. He's always looking out for victims of the legal system and trying to help them along. He won't take cases he doesn't believe in. He's just a fascinating guy. Anyway, Andy says, only God is perfect. The rest of us do our best. And so, it's like, if there's a misspelled word in a brief, you know, if some little I would be sweating over the content of the brief. So I'm like, is this worded right? Is this worded right? Is this going to do it? And Andy's like, relax. Only God is perfect. We do our best. It's fine. And he had such peace with that. I never had such peace with that.
I think if you can get into that state of mind, there's a lot of relief there. Because trying to get everything perfect is, one, impossible, and two, it just takes so much energy.
And yeah, it's like whack-a-mole.
It oh is God. Like whack-a-mole.
I was reading the best thing. Oh, man. I think I recycled it, but I put it in my, I scanned it first.
Okay.
It's the, boom.
Modern technology is.
Yep. Everything is at my fingertips. I am a god of human knowledge. Ah. Okay.
Bruce is currently looking something up on the computer.
Okay. These are the Chuck Jones rules for interaction between the coyote and the roadrunner.
Okay. Oh, okay. So Chuck Jones is the one who made this cartoon, right?
Yep.
And he has created a set of rules so that we know how that these two characters interact with each other all the time.
Yep.
Okay.
It's the best thing ever. Okay. Number one, Roadrunner cannot harm the coyote except for going beep, beep.
That's a good one.
Number two, no outside force can harm the coyote. Only his ineptitude or the failure of the Acme products. Number three, the coyote could stop at any time. And here's the quote, the reason I looked this up. Because it gets to the subject of what we were talking about. A fanatic, you know, and a perfectionist, I think, is a fanatic.
Okay.
And this is a quote from someone else. A fanatic is one who redoubles his effort when he has forgotten his aim.
Oh man, there's a lot in that, isn't there?
Yeah, and that seems to me to be what a perfectionist does. You know, that if when you get so bent on perfecting something rather than just getting it out of you as an artist, you know, it's your job to get stuff out of you. Mm-hmm. But if you get caught in perfectionism, I would argue you've lost your aim. Because your aim isn't to judge what you're doing. Your aim is to get it out of you and let somebody else have it.
Mm-hmm. And it's none of my business how they interpret it.
Right. That's so paralyzing, right?
Yep.
You know, I think of, playing jazz is a weird kind of music, right? Because all other music that is not that the whole purpose isn't improvisation. Jazz is a process, you know. If you go to hear some jazz, you go to watch X number of people engage in a process.
Mm-hmm.
And the process is you train, you know the form, you know how other people have handled it. But in the moment, there's you, there's your fellow people on stage, there's an audience, and you're being presented with something that will not have been created before. And you have to both try to have something to say. You have to stay out of the other X number of people's way who also have something to say. You have to lead with your ears so that you know what's going on. And somehow you have to make decisions in milliseconds. Mm-hmm. What you're going to contribute in real time. And then you also have this agreement with the audience, right? That they're here to watch you engage in this process. And you can't have perfectionism in that process. It's impossible. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If you break your train of thought at all, then you're out of it. It's milliseconds. It's 20, 30 milliseconds that you got to decide what you're doing and do it. It has to be instinctual or you will not. You'll fall out. You won't be a part of the process that's ongoing anymore. So I think that's a high pressure situation that's sort of demonstrative of the whole perfectionism thing, you know, that you can't do it as an artist. It takes you out of the process of making art.
Yeah. I think anytime I'm aware, specifically on the stage or on camera, on camera, it's even worse. Yeah. Anytime I'm aware of that I'm doing this thing and I'm judging it or I'm not 100% present in it, I'm not that character anymore, right?
Right.
I'm not making art. I'm not the character. I'm not, I've lost my aim.
Right, right. It's like your computer something has gone wrong in the code. And so it just goes, and it's like, oh, look, it's a gray box now.
Yeah. And on camera, the camera picks up things like that. So yep. It's like you were saying, in that millisecond, if you're not there and present and you lose it for that one moment, the camera goes, hey,
yeah,
he lost it for that. You know, it's like, exactly. Okay, then we don't believe her. Nope.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. And you hear the word, cut.
If you're lucky, you have that option to shoot another take.
Yeah.
If you're not, you don't.
Yep. Sorry, babe. One and done.
One and done.
Be better.
We'll fix it in editing.
That always works.
Yeah, especially if you only have a couple takes of each thing. Oh.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, when you were talking about that, it popped into my head. If we fast forward a couple of decades, we get stuck. When I was doing the work in progress screenings and getting feedback for the film, so Stuck is my feature film that a whole lot of people committed to and worked on. Bruce is one of those people who contributed in so many ways, including incredible score, music, soundscaping, like whatever you hear in that movie, it's Bruce. And we were doing those works in progress. Yep. And I was getting the feedback and I had like a pile. I had a pile of people here that was about this thick, about, you know, half an inch thick of feedback papers. They're like, oh yeah, this is great. And, da, da, da. And then I had the pile that was the same amount of thickness that was like, oh my God, this is terrible. What are you thinking? I hate that baby. That baby's crying too much, you know? And at that point, I had to take all those papers and stack them up and throw them away because it was just, it was just like, I can't please everybody.
No.
And there's no perfect version of this film except for the one that we just say, okay, it's done.
Yes.
And I remember you telling me that you'd had a conversation with somebody who said, I think you need to cut out, I don't remember, 20 more minutes of this film. And I was like, nope, not going to happen. We're just going to finish it.
I don't remember who said that now. Was it Julia?
I think so, yeah.
Might have been Julia. Julia is, Julia is the ruthless editor brain when she gets into ruthless editor brain.
Yes.
Another brilliant human.
Yeah. And I was actually, the first thing I was ever in on camera was Julia and Gretchen's trailer for Late Bloomers, the teaser.
Yep. And you also introduced me to Julia.
I did?
Yep. We went after a performance of The Three Cuckolds. Okay. You introduced me to Julia in the lobby. Julia and Gretchen had come to see it. And Julia says, let's all go out to dinner. So we went to dinner. And we went out and ate that night after a Three Cuckolds performance. And that's when I met Julia.
Wow. Okay, so this is important because, one, I didn't remember this at all, but two, Bruce has done so much work with Julia since then.
Right. Yep. That night, how many different projects? You skipped one, by the way, The Safety of Others.
Oh, I skipped so many things.
That we worked on?
Oh, yeah. We're going to have to do a whole other episode. Oh,
we're moving on now. The freight train has left the station.
We're going to have to go do a whole other episode, but I just find it
we're getting into all kind of crap, aren't we?
Oh, I think it's important. It's all connected.
It is.
So you never know when you might meet somebody who could be a part of your future, like a very amazing collaborator in your future. You never know when you might introduce somebody to someone that is going to be that person for them. I think that's really valuable. It's a thing to remember.
Absolutely. I mean, you're that important. You are an important person in my life for all of those reasons, for the reason of our ever-evolving relationship, for the reason of who we bring to each other, for the reasons of what we bring to each other. It's just it's a beautiful thing.
And it's been about 30 years.
Yep. Crazy to think that, isn't it?
It is. And I also want to emphasize that we are not in constant contact all the time. Through this 30 years, we've had years where we haven't talked. And then it's usually me that's like, hey, I've got a project.
Yeah, you're Little Miss Reachy-outy. which is awesome. It's awesome. But, the best part is that the breaks don't interrupt anything. We're just like immediately back on.
Yeah.
There's no adjustment period. Our time together is always intense and rewarding and wonderful in terms of a human relationship. How can it get better?
Yeah.
I wouldn't roll the dice for a better one. I like it.
Oh. Me too. Thank you.
Well, I mean, it's true.
I think that's important to acknowledge, because a lot of times what we see is we see in commercial industry, entertainment industry land, we have these stories of either people who are together forever, or they're together for a very short time and then they burn out and then they go their separate ways. But I think that in my head, I was supposed to have these long-term collaborators that I was going to be with all the time. Like I was going to be a part of a theater company And that was going to be my home. That didn't work out. You know, I was going to be a part of this other thing that was going to be kind of my home, and it didn't work out. But I'm my home, and I have collaborators around me that I get to go back to even when I haven't talked to them in a long time, or we haven't done anything in a long time. I think that that's an important thing for people out there to understand that can happen.
Yeah, it does. I think artists who stay in it for the long haul all have orbiting relationships, maybe is the metaphor for it, that your orbits may not all center around the same point, but you're artistically close and your orbits continue to cross each other. And the beautiful thing about it is every time an orbit crosses over, you're meeting up again with an artist you may have worked with, but they're bringing a whole new set of experiences and tools and projects and thoughts that you've never shared with them. So it's in some ways it's like meeting a totally new artist every time, but there's a language that you share already and a history that you share, and you have a way into what this new artist that you've worked with before many times is bringing to you today.
I like that.
I just made it up.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate that.
I probably stole it and just don't remember.
I don't think we used the word steal. I think we used the word, what is it? No, not appropriate. That's a bad word.
Yeah. No, you just got to go with the nitty gritty. It was okay. Wasn't it Stravinsky that said good artists borrow, great artists steal? Was that Stravinsky?
I don't know, actually. How can we not steal or borrow at this point?
Right. It all authentically is. It's in you. You know, what's Wes Anderson's latest thing? Atomic, bloody hell, what's the...
I don't know.
Now the Google has to tell me. Wes Anderson latest. You haven't seen it, have you? Asteroid City.
Oh, I have not seen this, no.
Okay, I'll set it up for you.
Okay.
It's kind of a play within a play within a documentary.
Of course it is.
it goes from Academy to I forget which wider format, dual format, black and white and color. But I think I would say this about it, because this is the distillation of what others have said, and I agree with it. If you like what Wes Anderson does, then imagine throwing 10,000 Wes Andersons in a paper bag and just having a big old sniff, because that's what you're going to get. And so if you don't like what Wes Anderson does, then you can use it to motivate you for whatever purpose you choose. But such an interesting movie. And he's a guy, man, his collaborators, that's a set of collaborators with the same, you know, they don't rotate around the same sun, but they orbit in close enough proximity where they're banging together maybe more often than some of us bang together. But, you see those actors. I mean, I think that's one reason people watch Wes Anderson films, right? To see who's going to be in the orbit of this film and see what they're going to bring to this film.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a COVID film.
Oh, so, boy.
Yeah. And in fact, oh my God, why am I Wes's major collaborator, former SNL?
No.
Oh, good grief.
Man. Well, I keep thinking of Jason Schwartzman, but that's...
Well, he's in it, but...
Bill Murray?
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
Good God.
You're welcome.
So, Bill Murray was supposed to be in it. He was supposed to play the innkeeper, and at the last minute, he got COVID. So he couldn't come on the set. And so Steve Carell zooms in and replaces him in the film.
Oh, that's an interesting swap, isn't it?
Okay. It is. It is. And, you know, I can imagine Bill Murray doing it, but Steve Carell does a bang-up job.
Wes Anderson has... So if you go back to Bottle Rocket, his first film.
Yep.
Like... That film is so very different from this trajectory that he went on.
Yeah, but preparing for this, I actually went back and watched Bottle Rocket.
Okay.
And you know what? You can still, it's all there. It's just more in its infancy, but the way he frames shots, the mm-hmm. all the little things that have become more distilled. They're in there.
Mm-hmm.
You can see them.
Just not as controlled as they are now.
Right.
And not as much money, probably, to control them with.
Oh, yeah.
Then versus now.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. So I think we're at a good stopping place. We have gotten, like, through, where are we at, 1992?
Yeah, this is an acid trip of an interview, isn't it?
That's okay. That's how these go.
That's okay. That's good. I'm in.
Yeah. No, we can put a pin in that where we ended. And we'll pick it up again at some other point.
Yes. This concludes part one.
Part one. Yes. This concludes part one. Thank you so much for dropping in today, Bruce Richardson, aging ingenue, Bruce Richardson.
Oh, right back at you, aging ingenue, Jenny Tooley. It's a good time.
It's a good time. I appreciate you coming. And I do hope that we can do another one.
I think we probably got another one or two in us, right?
Excellent. I think so, too. All right, you guys, so we'll be checking out now, and thank you all for listening. I hope you had a good day, and love ya. Thank you so much for listening today. I'm so glad to have you with me. Ooh, if something resonated with you, I sure hope that you'll take that and expand on it in your own life. Maybe you can apply it to something that's going on with you right now. If you really want to get in on the good magic, I'd head over to JennyTooley.com and grab up an interactive companion guide for season one and check out the mentorship program, because that's where the magic's gonna happen. All right, subscribe, join, yay, love you.